Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keynote, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. It is Saturday, March the 30th, 2024. We're up to over 2,000 episodes now on Keynote, and many of those episodes are focused on the nature of America, and particularly on how America is changing. Episode 1941, so that was a couple of months ago, I interviewed a journalist, Benjamin Herold, who has a new book out, or had a new book out a couple of months ago. It's already out now, Disillusioned, a book about the changing nature of American suburbs. The subtitle of the book is Five Families and the Unraveling of America's Suburbs, and it focuses on the changing culture and politics of American suburbia. It's an interesting book and an interesting thesis, rather sad in some ways, and makes sense, I guess, of the rise of Donald Trump and the change in the Republican Party. There are, of course, suburbs, which are the sprawling ends of towns, and then there's something else. Exurbs or exurbia, which is the extension of suburbia. And now we have a new book out on exurbia by one of America's leading political journalists, David Masiotra. Exurbia Now, the Battleground of American Democracy. And David is joining us, not from exurbia, but from Highland, Indiana, which is a suburb of Chicago. David, congratulations on the new book. It's out next week. What's the difference? I think some of our viewers and listeners will be a little bit confused. What's the difference between exurbia and suburbia?
Well, thank you for having me, Andrew, and congratulations on 2,000 episodes. The easiest way to make the distinction is to talk about distance and density. So an exurb has greater distance from the metro area than the suburb, and yet it has fewer people, so it has less population density.
And then when does the exurb become the countryside? When does it become rural America? We've also done shows on the politics of rural America. There seemed to be an interesting debate among some journalists about whether rural America is reactionary or not, whether it's Trump territory or Biden territory. When does America become rural as opposed to exurbian?
Well, exurbia is much more developed and it's much more manufactured. So typically exurbia is where people who first fled the metro areas into the suburbs are now fleeing. And the way this manifests politically is in a politics of escapism, a later stage of white flight, and reactionary beliefs of exclusion. So therefore, real estate development firms enter into exurbia and start creating new residential areas, and they often attract corporate chains, because one difference between rural America and exurbia is level of wealth. The Wall Street Journal finds that median household income in exurbia is about 15 to 20% higher than the median household income broadly across the United States, whereas rural America has much more poverty, it's less developed, and it's even further, typically, from the urban areas. Weighing in on that debate, is rural America reactionary or not? One of the errors that political analysts and journalists and commentators made following the election of Donald Trump in 2016 was to attribute much of his popularity in rural America to what was actually happening in exurbia. So as exurbs were growing, many journalists misinterpreted them as rural because of their proximity to rural areas. And this is also where you got several misnomers. For example, people who made heavy weather out of counties that had gone for Barack Obama flipping to Donald Trump. Well, what happened in many of these counties is the exurbs grew more populous and the suburbs grew less populous, thereby causing a shift in voting patterns.
To what extent, David, is this a semantic issue. Why can't we just lump exurbia and rural America together? What's the point of exurbia in conceptual terms?
Well, you raise a good question. And because I've written a book called Exurbia Now, I've had more discussion about the semantics regarding the term in the past week than I ever thought I would in my entire life. But there are some critical factors that are important to identify and appreciate if you want to develop a comprehensive understanding of what's happening right now in American politics. And first of all, I would say that an exurb bears much closer resemblance to a suburb than it does the bucolic country village. And that is for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's commercially more approximate to suburbia, but also because of how exurbia has grown. And as I was referencing earlier, it's a later stage of white flight. So it's people with a certain means of income looking to escape the diversification of their communities, and in some cases escape their communities becoming more progressive and more secular in their political and social comportment.
So in an odd way, it's a snapshot of what suburbs once were. Would it be fair to say that as non-white working class Americans move into the suburbs, so those white working class Americans are now pushed out, sometimes willingly, sometimes unwillingly, or sometimes consciously, sometimes even though they don't want to these exurbs?
Well, it's not so much as they're pushed out in terms of they retreat. So all of the data indicates, along with several studies, many of which I refer to in the book, that as minorities enter into the suburbs, white people exit. And it's not because there's a scarcity of housing or anything like that. It's because of the preference to create something resembling a white enclave. And this happens, you mentioned working class, but this happens at the same rate, sometimes even greater rates, among middle and upper class Americans. So for example, I live close to a town called Flossmoor, Illinois. Flossmoor, Illinois is a relatively wealthy area, mainly professional class. As Flossmoor has become more diverse, and as they have a more diverse city council, they recently had their first black chief of police, many white professionals have fled into exurbia as a social and cultural choice, not one of economic necessity.
So perhaps we should be rethinking exurbia as a statement of geography and more one of culture or of race. Is by definition then exurbia made up of white Americans? Are there some exurbs which are racially diverse? I mean, obviously you've got African Americans, but also an increasing number of Hispanic American.
They're predominantly white, but not obviously not exclusively or not entirely. And some of the way this manifests politically is quite fascinating because, for example, the most common characteristic among those who participated in the mob attack on the Capitol of January 6, 2021 was residency in a county, typically suburban or exurban, to your question, that has a growing non-white population, black, Latino, or Asian, and also a county where the black-white poverty gap is shrinking, either because the blacks are making gains or the whites are falling behind. This was the number one driver of the people who stormed the Capitol. And
it was all those fat white guys with their beards and their walkie-talkies fantasizing about being Al Capone or Al Pacino.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, that's an amusing characterization of it, but it's largely
well, I don't know
correct.
If it's amusing, but I don't think it is particularly amusing, but it that's what struck me. David, one of the early reviews of your book talked about something called the Confederacy stronghold of Northern Illinois. much of your argument falls back on race, and of course the tragic history of race in this country, really much, many people believe, defines the whole history of America. Is this just chapter 11 or 12 in the history of racial unrest and distrust and dislike in America?
In many ways, it is. So the Confederacy stronghold of Northern Illinois, that comes from Exurbia now itself. That's what the headline I gave a chapter, and that refers to an incident in my childhood. I went to high school in a town called Lansing, Illinois, a south suburb of Chicago, and our mascot name was the Rebels. So therefore, the school, until the late 1990s, flew a Confederate flag on its grounds. And once the student body, along with the surrounding community, became more diverse, predominantly with Black residents, there were protests and there was a demand to remove the Confederate banner because Black people sending their kids to this school didn't view it as harmless. They viewed it as a symbol of slavery and secession. And a major kerfuffle came about in the town, including whites marching around the streets with Confederate flags and dressed in Civil War regalia. And I present this as a foretelling of much of the politics that would become popular during the Trump years. So the embrace of hateful iconography, the idea of great replacement, because at the same time, many of these Lansing residents were fearing that usurpation from Blacks and Latinos would rid them of their financial agency and their political power. So it works as somewhat analogous and emblematic of where our politics have gone in the Trump years. And as you say, in many ways, we're still fighting the Civil War. In many ways, we're still dealing with the fallout from Jim Crow. And the dream of a multiracial democracy, to which we've made significant progress, sometimes miraculous progress, is still the center of our most combative conflicts and volatile arguments.
As you know, one of the chapters in the book is called The Confederacy Stronghold of Northern Illinois. You're talking to me from Highland, Indiana, not far from Northern Illinois, Midwest, of course. Is your analysis of this Exurbia, is it true throughout the country? Or in California, I'm guessing it exists in the north, in the Northeast. Does it exist in the South as well, in outside towns like Atlanta?
Yes, absolutely. So in my book, I draw most heavily on where I live, suburbs of Chicago, northern Indiana, a little bit of southern Michigan. However, I also bring in references to other exurban developments, political, cultural, social, economic, throughout the country, including the South. And Atlanta is of particular importance, because as Atlanta has become something of a mecca of Black cultural and political power, and the suburbs surrounding Atlanta have become much more liberal in their voting patterns and their local culture, Exurbia of Atlanta, as is the pattern throughout the country, has grown increasingly right-wing and increasingly favorable to Donald Trump. And this actually predates Trump. In the 1990s, many of the most vociferously hostile Republican congressmen against the Clinton administration and against the growing diversity then of the Democratic Party represented exurban districts of Georgia. This is going on all over the country. It just so happens that I'm situated in an area that makes for a good rendering of it.
So this is the old chicken and egg question, David. I'm sure you've had it many times before. What comes first, Exurbia or Marjorie Taylor Greene and Donald Trump's America? Are these people who flee the suburbs for Exurbia, are they already political reactionaries? Are they already racist? Are they already hostile to diversity? And has Exurbia become the new Confederacy? Is it somehow compounding these ideas, which I know you don't like, I certainly don't like, and I'm guessing most of our audience aren't very keen on?
Well, it's, I won't solve the classic conundrum of the chicken and the egg, but I hope I can shed some insight on it. So the lovable and psychotic characters like Green and Gates and Jim Jordan and Lauren Boebert, they represent districts that are predominantly exurban. Now, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? You're correct. The people who move into Exurbia tend to have right-wing beliefs and tend to want to live.
I don't know if I'm even comfortable with it. They're populist or white populism.
Well, that's interesting. We could get to that point, but it's a selective populism, which the Italian philosopher and social critic Umberto Eco famously defined as one of the chief characteristics of a fascist comportment, selective populism. But to your question, they move to those areas with those beliefs, but then various factors of Exurbia, along with social media algorithms, help to heighten those beliefs, help to intensify them. So for example, most megachurches are in Exurbia. Megachurches have become essentially citadels of Christian theocratic politicking. Most exurban counties lack local media. So the people who live there, if they're looking for some insight into politics, they tend to go to national media or social media. If they already have a right-leaning comportment, the algorithms are going to lead them further and further down the rightward track. Most exurban areas, as we were saying earlier, lack a certain social diversity that makes it easier for its inhabitants to believe that the Latino immigrant presents a terrible threat to them, or the gay teenager is going to corrupt their children. If they're not around these people and they don't see different, it's easy to believe what Fox News is preaching or what Steve Bannon is telling them. So there's a symbiosis there.
A symbiosis? I don't know what the word is for a problematic symbiosis, but it's not one I think is very healthy for America, or perhaps for even the people living in the exurbs. We are speaking with David Masiotra, the author of a really interesting new book, Exurbia Now, about the most right-wing parts of America. The book is subtitled The Battle Ground of American Democracy. It may be a battleground where the battle has already been determined. We will come back to that after the break. I want to remind everyone that great guests like David Masiotra are brought to us because of the support for Keenon of Liberties, a quarterly journal of culture and politics. Excellent new publication. David's going to get a free subscription as one of our guests, going to run a short feature on Liberties. And then we'll be back with David Masiotra to talk a little bit more about what these exurbs are really like physically, geographically, and of course, economically. So we'll be back in a second.
News, the noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberties is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberties is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberties at your favorite bookseller.
And you can subscribe to Liberties at libertiesjournal.com. We're speaking with the Indiana-based journalist, David Masiotra. He writes regularly for Salon, a number of other interesting publications. He has a new book out, Exurbia Now, The Battleground of American Democracy. Before the break, David, we talked about the populist nature, right-wing populism of the Marjorie Taylor Greene, Donald Trump wing of the Republican Party. The strength is not in the old suburbia, but in exurbia. I wonder what these places look like? There seems to be a strong, and it's one of the contradictions, it seems to me, in American populism. This simultaneously holding of a strong libertarian streak, as well as a reliance on government, government handouts, a strong government to do stuff that you want done by government. So it's certainly not the old free market libertarianism of the traditional Republican Party. Are these exurbs, I imagine, places where people live, if not in the woods, certainly isolated from one another, where there's very little public space? Is there local government in the exurbs? I mean, who gets elected, and how do these places operate? Do they have sewage plants? Do they have electricity?
Yeah, that's the yes, they are part of the modern world, after all, even if they have some pre-modern, prehistoric beliefs. The local government, of course, tends to be rather right-wing, and it's in many exurban counties where we're seeing book bans coming after bookshelves in the libraries and in the public schools. During the COVID-19 pandemic, it was often in exurban counties where people were storming the school board meetings and saying, unmask our children, reopen businesses, no vaccine requirements. And this is happening according to a plan. And I don't mean that in any conspiracy theory sense, smoke-filled rooms or anything cloak and dagger. But Stephen Bannon, for example, who was the chief advisor to the Donald Trump campaign.
And who looks as if he just wandered out of his local exurbia.
His local exurbia.
Even though he's a wealthy guy, I think he fashions himself as an exurbian Leninist.
Right. Yeah, he does exurban Leninism. That should have been the title of the book. I will talk to my publisher about the paperback edition.
You're right, and your left-wing readers on that. You're probably better off without it. But anyway.
Yes, a good point. We do want to sell these things after all. But anyway, to your question about the local government and Bannon is one of many right-wing influential figures who has said, run for local office, become an election worker, get on your school board, get on your library trustees board. And many of his listeners are responding to the call. This is how a group called Moms for Liberty formed, which is the number one driver of the book bans happening across the country. So as you could guess, the politics of exurbia locally resemble the desires of exurban residents nationally. It's very right-wing. If you want to call it right-wing populism, that's fine. It's very reactionary and it's very exclusionary, and it tends to manifest in paranoia. So here again, the books on the shelf that deal with Black history or have a transgendered protagonist are going to somehow lead to civilizational collapse. And therefore, we have to take action. And all of this has a long history of the United States. After all, Richard Hofstadter wrote The Paranoid Style of American Politics in the 1960s about people who behaved in ways similar to what I'm documenting and describing in exurbia now.
What about public space, David? When we drive, and unfortunately, for better or worse, we coastal elites drive through these places. We haven't spent much time there as you have. Is there any public space? Is there parkland, pavement? Are there places where these people congregate? Or is that only when they get angry and go to school board meeting?
So there really isn't. And that's interesting. There are parks, of course, for children to play games on the playground, and there might be a basketball hoop, but there isn't much public space for congregation, collaboration. There aren't many third places. The great sociologist Ray Oldenburg defined the third place as not home, not work, but a place where people could assemble with some comfort and congeniality and camaraderie. There are corporate chains, restaurants and stores, and there's a lot of pavement. There are a lot of roads, and there's a lot of automobile traffic. And in fact, many of the neighborhoods lack sidewalks, so it's not even conducive to walking. And one of the urban planners I quote in my book comes right out and says it, that sidewalks communicate to people that they might be welcome here. They could come and walk through the neighborhood. So if you don't have the sidewalk, you're communicating the opposite message. You're not welcoming people. And that becomes particularly important to the exurbanites on a day like Halloween, where children might want to trick or treat. And one thing that happens in the United States is poor residents, working class residents who live in apartment buildings will drive into a residential neighborhood to trick or treat. Well, they can't do that in Exurbia because there are no sidewalks. I suppose they could. They could walk all over the lawns, but they're discouraged from doing so. So that your question is a very insightful one, because the lack of public space, the lack of third places, enhances the isolation of the inhabitants of Exurbia. And isolation often leads to political extremism, both of the right-wing and left-wing variety. It just so happens that the greatest threat right now in the United States is of the right-wing variety.
Yeah, and of course, another reason, I guess, probably in terms of your thesis at least, why there aren't sidewalks is they don't want young kids of other skin colors wandering around. And of course, these are the sorts of places where if you're an unlucky black kid wandering around, you might get beaten up or even killed.
Yes, and that's the most catastrophic.
Are the police in the game here? I mean, in the old days in the South, in Mississippi of the 60s, the police were essentially in the same camp as the Confederates, as the racists. Are the police part of the problem in the exurbs?
Well, it's interesting you raise that. So one of the towns that I profile in the book, it's actually the town where I obtained my master's degree, Valparaiso, Indiana, home to Valparaiso University. Valparaiso, throughout even the 70s, was what historians would refer to as a sundown town. Meaning, if you're black and you find yourself in this town after the sun sets, you're in for some big trouble. You'll either be arrested on trumped up charges, beaten, or perhaps even worse. The first black family to move to that town was the Cottons. A little boy at the time named Robert Cotton is now an adult male, and he's on the city council. So these towns can change. He's one of the heroes of the book. That's one of the hopeful chapters of the book. But the police are often a bulwark against that change, because we see in Exurbia, even though these areas are predominantly white and they don't have public transit, which is another important factor, when Black and Latino residents do congregate in these towns, there are greater incidents of racial profiling from the police. Not so much violence, because the crime rates in these towns are so low, but a more subtle form of harassment exclusion that comes from racial profiling, getting stopped for a traffic ticket, things of that nature.
David, the subtitle of the book, Exurbia Now, is The Battleground of American Democracy. In the Cold War age, a lot of European thinkers came to America, came up with theories of totalitarianism. Hannah Arendt, of course, and also the Frankfurt School, and they saw, in the context perhaps of borrowing from theorists of American democracy, Tocqueville in particular, that the foundations of totalitarianism were built when you did away with the intermediary institutions between the individual and the state, the churches, the unions, the clubs, the very things that Tocqueville argued, at least in his Democracy in America, made 19th century American democracy so revolutionary. And of course, in 2024, where the Republican Party, driven by its exurban wing, seems to be more and more hostile to American democracy in an unashamedly overt way, is there a kind of dark irony to the foundations of totalitarianism being built in Exurbia, which means that the ideology seems almost natural.
Yeah, that's a very perceptive point. And as you mentioned, Tocqueville constantly wrote about the importance of voluntary associations, and Robert Putnam, who's been on our show
a couple of times.
Oh, great! I'll look for those episodes. So you're probably more familiar with his work than I am. But his classic Bowling Alone warns of the danger of the death of these intermediary institutions, the danger of the death of communal recreational outlets. And that danger is now playing out in Exurbia. And there is a dark irony to it, because the Exurbanites are at the same time lost in nostalgia. And they're romanticizing the past to such a degree. First of all, it's unrealistic how they're romanticizing it, but they're romanticizing it to such a degree that they're running the risk that Albert Camus described when he said that the politics of nostalgia can lead to romanticizing the past to such a degree that you're willing to do evil for an unrealizable good. And in Exurbia, there is this idea that they are part of the real America, because the real America is a predominantly white Christian country village where everyone goes to church on Sunday, lives in a traditional nuclear family unit, and they turn on the television and they see something very different playing out in pop culture and often the case in politics, and they react with rage and hostility. And that rage and hostility might undermine constitutional democracy, which is the chief mechanism of American prosperity, American freedom, and American greatness.
And of course, as you note, contemporary American exurbs are dystopian versions of those original American communities, which probably never existed. Anyway, you mentioned Robert Putnam, Bowling Alone, of course, he's most famous for his last book, and he was on the show talking about it. It's called The Upswing, How America Came Together a Century Ago and How We Can Do It Again. He's cautiously optimistic. He thinks America goes through cycles of breaking apart and then coming back together. In your analysis of Exurbia now, do you share that optimism, or are the divisions becoming even deeper because of the prevalence of Exurbia?
I'm also cautiously optimistic. So I would say I'm about 60% optimistic and 40% fatalistic, because we are cutting it a bit thin. It could go either way. But the thing to know about Exurbia is that it's essentially a backlash. It's an adverse reaction to some major changes and trends sweeping the United States, changes and trends that began in the 1960s with the soft revolution of the civil rights movement. And it's because of all of the gains of Blacks, Latinos, Asians, LGBTQ Americans, and others that these people feel that they're losing their country. And there are various aspects of the American system of governance that work in the Exurbanites' favor, namely the Electoral College and the skewed representation of the United States Senate. But everything indicates that America is moving in a more liberal direction, and that's what's creating this backlash. A great political scientist by the name of David Ferris has a book called The Kids Are All Left. And he assiduously documents how Americans under the age of 40 are voting Democratic at a much higher degree than generations of the past. They're much more secular than generations of the past. They have much more socially liberal beliefs than generations of the past. So,
do you know this? As I said, do you know the author of The Kids Are All Left?
Yes, I do.
We'll have to get him on the show.
Oh, yeah, I will.
It's a fascinating area and a very important area, David. Finally, excuse me, thinking about the kids are all left or the kids are all right or the kids are both on the left and the right. What about the kids of Exurbia? When you drive through these places, you always imagine, as we elite coastal types imagine, oh, I couldn't imagine living here. I bet anyone who grows up wants to get out as quickly as they can. It's clearly made up of middle-aged and older white Americans. Are the kids who grow up here, are they wanting to leave, or are they simply becoming versions of their parents?
Well, something strange is happening in American culture where more and more young people are replicating their parents' behavior. But that aside, you're onto something with your question. Many of exurban children want to go to college. They want to get out of this town. They want to interact with more cultural vitality and variety.
There probably aren't many job opportunities there.
Exactly.
There's no public space. There's very little public government.
Yeah, you just read my mind. I was just about to say, and then once they get out of college, the path toward a great career is through a city or a densely populated suburb. It's not in exurbia. And this is part of what's motivating this relentless attack on higher education that's coming from the American right wing, is that, and there are problems with American higher education, to be sure. And I wouldn't say that it's a utopian society. However, much of it is fear-based, because they know that when their children become of age and they get into a university and they acquire new information, they may become more skeptical about the attitudes with which they were raised, the attitudes regarding politics, religion, race, sexuality, and a whole host of other issues.
Finally, David, I live in San Francisco, surrounded by wealthy liberal neighbors. Many of my friends live in Washington, D.C. or Manhattan. Should we, wealthy coastal liberal elite, should we be moving to our local exurbia to break this thing up?
Well, that's if you want to take on that sacrifice, then more power to you. We appreciate your
service. I think I'll leave it to you, David.
But all right, I'll bear the burden, as John F. Kennedy said, and pay the price. But no, I would say, you know, to anyone really worried about this problem, as many people should be, the most important thing to do is to vote. And also, if you live in an exurb or if you live in a small suburb, get involved locally, because what often happens is the book banners, the Moms for Liberty types, they can overwhelm these town councils because no one's paying any attention in the community. So a very small amount of people can have a major impact in these towns. Very briefly, I'll just offer a summary, a thumbnail. I tell a story in my book about a small group of people in the town where I lived, which is a small suburb, that got the town council to adopt an environmental sustainability commission, even though the town council was 3-2 in favor of Republicans. And that's because people aren't participating at the local level. When a small group of even 20 people gets involved and starts making noise, the politicians pay attention. So that's my recommendation. Don't just vote, but don't just do so at the national level. Also do so.